You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 11th to the 17th of February 2016. My name is John Elms, and today I'm joined by Deputy News Editor John Morgan and reporters David Matthews and Chris Havergal. In the news this week, following on from his statement that England should be utterly ashamed of having the highest fees in the developed world, Leader of the Opposition Jeremy Corbyn has given a sit-down interview to Times Higher Education. John Morgan, who was the recipient of Mr. Corbyn's responses, will take us through that in a little while. Elsewhere, the belief that Chinese students lack critical thinking skills because of their authority-revering traditional culture has been questioned by some academic research, which suggests a more modern and sinister reason. David will be giving us a lowdown on that. And following on from last week's THE Middle East and North Africa Summit, Chris Havergal has returned from the United Arab Emirates, chock full of insight from the conference. Chris will be giving us his debrief on that. But John, you first. You've just had an interview with Jeremy Corbyn.
So he was speaking at a University and College Union event where he gave a speech that was rapturously received. And once he'd fought his way through the crowd of UCU members seeking a selfie with him, he spoke to me and I asked him, well, interestingly, we haven't heard a lot from him since he was elected leader about his keystone pledge to scrap tuition fees and reintroduce student maintenance grants. Mm. And in his speech at the UCU event, it was noticeable that even though he criticised very strongly 9K fees, and said it, you know, we should be utterly ashamed that England has the most highest fees of any public institutions in the world, he didn't actually talk about his own pledge to scrap fees, which is, you know, a reflection of the very sensitive politics within the Labour Party, where the vast majority of Labour's MPs aren't in agreement with him on a number of policy issues. So, but in the interview, it was notable that he did talk about his pledge to scrap fees. So that's really the first public discussion of that policy that we've heard from him since he was elected leader. So I started off by asking him, does it remain his stance that he wants to see fees scrapped? And he said, that's what I fought the leadership election on. It requires serious debate and discussion within the party to achieve this. I've discussed it with John McDonnell, the Shadow Chancellor. We're discussing the model of the funding required and what's involved. And then he explained there'll be a debate within the party and a conclusion after that. But him saying that he's talked it over with McDonnell, you can tell, you know, this is very much the policy that he wants to get through. Clearly they're doing some planning behind it, and the plan is to get Labour to adopt it officially as Labour policy, although you will have people like Andy Burnham, who supported a graduate tax in his leadership campaign. So, and there's also people like Liz Kendall who backed the 9K status quo. So there's going to be quite a policy battle within Labour, I'd imagine, if Corbyn wants to get fees being scrapped as the party's official position. And I said, you know, is he hopeful that tuition-free higher education will become the Labour position? Yes, he said, I'm hopeful. Yeah, he kind of held back on saying he was hopeful. I think he's so worried about any attempts to kind of any perception that he's trying to railroad through his own policy. Mm. So he pulled back on the word hopeful. And he said, I'm not a dictator. So, you know, he's emphasising that there's going to be debate.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, it's clearly from that, it suggests that even he is unsure about, you know, how difficult this might be, because obviously there's going to be so much opposition. His own leadership candidates, opposition candidates, were had differing opinions. So when he'd stopped on hopeful, I mean, what kind of indication did that give you on how viable this would be?
It indicates that he's very worried about, you know, about being seen to say that any kind of position, be it on tuition fees or on Trident, will automatically become Labour policy. You know, he's recognising the fact that the vast majority of MPs don't share his views on key policies. But what he might take solace from is the fact that you know, getting rid of fees or significantly reducing them is increasingly, you know, a big topic on on the world stage internationally. We've got Bernie Sanders in the US who's saying that he wants public universities and colleges to be free. Hillary Clinton's got this more cautious policy for debt-free higher education. In Chile, the President Michelle Bachelet elected on a pledge to bring in free higher education after huge student protests. So there is this international movement in some countries towards you know, fee-free higher education having a big place in political debate at the very least, and that's partly what our cover feature this week looks at. I looked at the question of whether there can ever be an optimum balance between public and private funding for higher education. Is there ever, you know, an ideal ratio between the two, or is that purely a kind of moral judgment, or is it more just based on the nature of the societies and their sort of political heritage and their, you know, traditional relationship to taxation and public spending? Or can you go, is it actually all about what the private funding is doing? You know, if you use it for income contingent loans like England, like Australia, can you pretty much push fees as high as you like, because income contingent loans are basically magic and no students ever get deterred? So kind of there's a link between the Corbyn interview and the cover feature in terms of looking at those big issues of funding.
Absolutely. Well, as John rightly points out, his two pieces, very hard-hitting, very fascinating pieces in their own right, and can be found on pages 6 and 7, and page 34 is, I think, John's feature. Definite questions that the sector will want to have to answer and will want to know about. David, slightly different tack for your story this week. You've been unearthing some research that talks about about Chinese students in particular.
Hmm. Yeah, so I'm sure lots of listeners will be aware of the idea that Chinese students, I mean, when they come to the West, when they come to the UK, either undergraduate or master's level, perceive to kind of lack critical thinking skills. You know, there's been lots of criticism that they will just sort of cut and paste arguments from other people and fit them into an essay, rather than, you know, really understanding the concept of actually, you know, coming up with your own ideas and defending them. I mean, that's clearly not true for everyone, but it definitely exists as a perception, and I'm sure there is some truth behind it. Now, the blame for that often falls on Chinese culture, as it were, in inverted commas. This idea that there's this long Confucian tradition in China that reveres authority, unlike the kind of liberal-minded, independent West, where people feel they can challenge authority. This is not the whole picture. According to Tao Zhang, he's a lecturer at Nottingham Trent University, who interviewed, admittedly not a huge number, so it's not some sort of big study, but it's a fairly detailed focus group at her own university of master's students at Nottingham Trent. And she basically thinks that the explanation might be the propaganda students are fed at university level. What's really interesting is that if you're a Chinese undergraduate, no matter what subject you have to do, you have to study these four books. One of them is on sort of Mao Zedong thought, Marxist-Leninism, a kind of vague one called sort of Morals and Politics, and then there's one also on recent Chinese history, you know, with the official history of the Communist Party and, and so on. And what's really interesting is the students she interviewed, I mean, very few of them actually believe this. You know, there's been other stories about this. You know, the New York Times students sort of sleeping through their Marxism lectures and so on. They just basically swap for it and then do it to pass the exams. They don't really care.
Yeah.
But she's making the point, even though they may not actually actually, you know, imbibe the beliefs that they're given, what it does is sort of chips away at this idea that independent thought is valuable. If you've got to basically, if you get through university by passing an exam, by regurgitating knowledge you're told by the government, you know, what does that do for your, you know, how you approach knowledge? And the, I mean, the students were, you know, she asked them, what is critical thinking? And they're like, well, I just don't know. We've never come across it before we came to the UK. So she's saying, don't think this is all about ancient Chinese culture or something. This is not some big East-West culture divide. It's just simple propaganda.
And how much of a sort of presence is that, this sort of rote learning about these Marxist texts? Is it, would it be at Peking and Tsinghua? They have to do it right through to every kind of, every single local university, and how much time they have to spend with?
It's not, you know, a massive amount of time, I don't think. But you, there are four fairly chunky textbooks you have to get through.
And it's mandatory.
It's mandatory. But as I say, I mean, it's not something you revise hard for. People don't care about it. I mean,
it's the general studies.
Yeah, it's exactly. It's the equivalent of doing general studies at A-level to get an extra A-level grade or something. I don't think people are particularly swayed by it. But, you know, there is that sort of slightly insidious message behind it, isn't it? You study this or else.
Absolutely. David's story, really fascinating piece of research done by Tao Zhang, is on page 12 of our magazine. And finally, last but not least, Chris, you've come back from the UAE where we had a MENA summit, and you've been reporting for THE. What did you find out from our conference?
Yeah, so this was our MENA University Summit held at United Arab Emirates University. And there were university leaders from across Middle East and North Africa represented there. I mean, what was very clear to me, having, you know, attended the conference, was the scale of the ambition that many of the universities and countries hold for higher education. The challenge then, if you're looking to expand and develop at a fast pace from, you know, effectively, you know, in some countries, you know, from not really having much of a higher education system a couple of decades ago, is where do you draw your sort of models and ideals for what higher education should look like? Should you go for a Western model? Should you go for a liberal arts style education? Or should you try to create something which fits more to you know, an Islamic tradition of education? That came to the fore very much in two debates at the summit. One of these was about graduate skills. And there's a debate involving a lot of university leaders about whether graduates of universities had the skills that were needed for the workplace. And it came across that graduates and students were very interested in getting technical sort of vocational skills because they felt that that would help them in the workplace. But Ali bin Saud Al Bimani, who's the vice chancellor of a university in Oman, said, and I quote, "I've got engineers, doctors and nurses who know their jobs, but they don't know how to deal with people." A suggestion that, you know, universities need to create human beings as well as people who can sort of just do jobs. And so there's a debate there. Do you go for sort of a broader liberal arts style model, or do you go for something else? And certainly the answer that was coming through at the conference was looking at a way to sort of reimagine that broader based education before Islamic identity, sort of fitting it into those traditions, but also making the case to students that it is worthwhile having these broader skills. I mean, just one, I said there were two debates where it really came through. And the other one was a discussion with Lisa Anderson, who stepped down as the president of the American University in Cairo at the end of last year. And she talked about the fact that many of the universities in the region are quite young. And as a result, they might feel you know, bashful or intimidated around the sort of elite universities of the Western world. What she said was, you know, don't apologise for being young. It's actually an advantage to be a young university. And she introduced the concept of leapfrogging. And this is usually used in sort of economic development, where countries can sort of accelerate their progress by skipping all of the sort of technologies which maybe the Western world has sort of got through and improved upon. She was saying new universities, you don't have the burden of old campuses, old libraries, old laboratories, maybe old methods of teaching. You can go straight to the front and, you know, really push your development forward. So there's nothing to be apologetic about.
Sure, sure. So, I mean, the prevailing ideas are that there's opportunities for the universities in this region for, you know, making a bigger part on the world stage.
Yeah, very much there's opportunities, but also, I mean, the flip side to that, and it's sort of unavoidable talking about these issues, is that, you know, there's a lot of variation across the region, and you can't forget that there's areas like Syria, potentially Palestine, where just operating a higher education system is, you know, much, much more challenging. We heard sort of stories of, you know, university presidents who, you know, not only had to go around with dozens of bodyguards, but, you know, would actually carry a gun on them when they're going around campus. And of course, there are many universities, you know, particularly in Syria, that have, you know, been forced to sort of decamp, you know, in full to sort of, you know, refugee camps. Mm. So certainly there's potential. There's also a lot of variety. And I think, in particular, people were looking to some of the more affluent states in the region, you know, be it the sort of the oil-rich Gulf states, to you know, provide leadership and collaboration, you know, with, you know, universities across the region.
Although, yeah. Was there any discussion when you were there of the impact of the crash in oil prices on some of these very oil-rich systems? I mean, you've got Saudi Arabia that launched KAUST a few years ago, which is this very, very expensive, you know, institutions supposed to attract lots of American academics, something like $10 billion endowment or something like that. You know, was there a sense that that might be threatened, these prestige projects in the Gulf?
I mean, I think certainly there's a recognition that that's a possibility. I think there's already been discussion of sort of all the scholarships that Saudi Arabia offers. You know, could they be under threat, and in particular Qatar? I know another state which has put huge amounts into higher education, again, spending is likely to be cut back there. That said, it wasn't as if that was the issue on the tip of the tongue of every university president there. And there is another way of looking at it, in that, you know, these universities have largely been set up to diversify those economies and to sort of provide the route away from an oil-dependent economy to one that's based around sort of knowledge production, high-tech manufacturing. So, you know, it could be the case that in the short to medium term, at least, you know, that actually serves to, you know, heighten the case for investment in universities.
Yep.
The question is whether it can now be sustained over the long term.
Mm. Well, Chris's comprehensive coverage of Armenia University Summit is to be found on pages 8 and 9. It's a full spread with many insights from the key players who were at the conference. I'm afraid, though, that's all we've got time for in this week's issue review. But, of course, you can check out all the matters discussed and more news, features and book reviews in our physical magazine or on our website, timeshigheducation.com. Naturally, as I say every week, we welcome your input. And if you'd like to comment on anything from this week's edition, you can find us on social media, Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, Google+, etc. And of course, our website. Please do get in touch. We'd love to hear from you. But until next week, goodbye.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.